Music and Booze with Mo is co-produced and distributed by Nitty Grits, the media division of the National Food and Beverage Foundation, changing the world one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there's a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. On this episode, we travel to Las Vegas, baby. We went to hit up the iconic Atomic Liquors and find ourselves a musician that was working behind the bars there. And we found one. His name is Jackson Milgaten, and he sat and talked with us for a while about music, because he plays in a band I've even heard of, and cocktails, because, you know, Atomic Liquors isn't just a dive bar. It's a dive bar with classy drinks, and you don't have to get dressed up to go there. And that's one of the things we love about that place so much. So sit with us and let's talk about Atomic Liquors, the voyage from music to booze, and kind of how you can do both at the same time for a little while. It's all about creativity, and here is Jackson.
We're on. Sweet. So we can just do this thing then.
Hello, hello.
Everything's here, so we're totally fine.
All right.
So I always start these things off having you introduce yourself.
All right.
To everybody who you are and where you work.
My name is Jackson Milgaten, and we are sitting in my place of employment right now. This is Atomic Liquors downtown on Fremont Street
in
Las Vegas, Nevada. Fabulous Las Vegas.
How long have you been here with Atomic?
About a year.
A year?
Yeah.
So how long have you been slinging drinks?
I've been working in the industry for maybe like 15 years now.
Wow, really?
Well, almost, yeah, because I basically started right when I turned 21.
Really?
I always like to hear how... At that 15-year mark.
Right, oh. It's okay.
No, I'm not worried.
I always like to hear how people got started, though. Was this like a college job that just never left? Was it a way to make extra money when you were playing music?
This actually ties in well to the podcast. I was in bands. I've been a lifelong musician, and I was in touring bands all throughout my 20s. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I was living in San Diego.
I'm from San Diego.
Are you really?
Yeah, what part of San Diego?
All right, so I mean, I lived in pretty much like every neighborhood in the city proper.
I'm an Encinitas kid, so okay. I'm North County, which is a little different than the rest of San Diego.
So I was like always, you know, right in the like rectangle of freeways down there in like the center of the city, basically.
Yeah, totally. So this would have been early 2000s.
Yeah, this
late
is
90s.
Yeah, no, early to mid 2000s.
Okay,
I started living there, and I moved into an apartment that was above a bar called the Turf Supper Club, and the guy that owned that place also owns some venues in town. One of them being the Casbah, which is kind of like people consider it the
legendary
CBGBs of the West.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had played a couple shows there that I had booked communicating with him, Tim Mays, through email only, so I'd never actually met him in person. And one night I was at a show there with a friend of mine, and she knew that I lived above Turf and knew that I hadn't met him, so she introduced me, and pretty much like the first thing out of his mouth was, "Do you want a job?" And I was like, sure, you know, doing what? Thank you so much,
Perfect.
Gary. And he wanted me to do the door at the Turf Club. And, you know, I'm not a huge guy. I don't necessarily look like a bouncer. But I was like, if you want me to do it, if you think I can do this, then fine, I'll do it. And I just started doing that one day a week. Mm-hmm. And kind of like over the course of my 20s, throughout all the time that I worked there, I got more involved with the bar and started like working the door a couple days a week, and then started floating and like working in the kitchen and as a host, and then eventually I started bar backing, you know, the rest
worked
is history.
Behind the bar, yeah.
But it was kind of this interesting symbiotic relationship that I had with it, because I, as my career as a musician kind of started to pick up, that was like as I was getting really involved there, but it was a great place because he was so into music and owned so many venues and bars around town.
Yeah.
Everyone that worked for him was basically a rock and roller. So they were super supportive of you just going on tour for a few months and
yeah.
then coming back and jumping right in.
Yeah.
So I kind of like, as my music career went on and I was on the road more and more, I continued to work there whenever I was in town, which was great. And then kind of towards the end of my 20s, when my touring life kind of started to wrap itself up a little bit, I got more and more into this accidental career of bartending that I just fell into. And kind of as one thing started to fade out a little bit,
the other
went to
more prominence, right?
Yeah.
I hear that a lot from musicians and everything. It's actually, if you want a sip of that, it's actually kind of how I started doing this podcast.
Okay.
Was just finding, I worked in radio during the 90s, 10 years up north in Northern California, and then started working in music publishing. So I've always been involved in the music industry somehow, and found that a lot of those friends I had in my 20s who were playing in bands, a lot of them, they started kind of morphing out of being as musical as they had been, you know, not making any money, it's not really going anywhere, maybe just keeping it at home and turning it into dad bands or whatever.
Sure.
A lot of them started buying bars, working more often within bars, and there's that kind of line of creativity that I think kind of changes itself over. Or maybe they're fantastic cooks at this point.
Yeah.
I've got a friend who has been in many like hardcore death metal bands, and he's a brilliant chef, such a good cook. So when he wasn't touring, he was catering, you know?
Yeah.
And there's that kind of side to it. So for you now doing bartending, how are you getting to create your own cocktails? Have you been able to have that kind of freedom doing it too?
Yeah.
Expressing that way?
I have. I've been fortunate to kind of come into that aspect of the industry in a very casual and natural way as well. I just had some people pretty much take me under their wing that you know, have all come from very different backgrounds and experiences within the industry. And a couple of those people just happened to be really knowledgeable, experienced in a more, whether you want to call it craft or classic style of bartending. But
there's talk now that the craft cocktail itself is dead, only in that the idea of craft cocktails when they first kind of kicked off was that bars started making their own syrups and getting fresh juices, and now that's expected.
Yeah.
You know, it's so proliferated.
Yeah.
Bars everywhere. You can even go to some crappy bar and they'll still like probably have their own syrups of some kind.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, do you even bother
old
saying
podcasting.
That anymore? Because, you know, what's the point? Everyone comes in and they expect you to have fresh juice now.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's kind of weird saying craft cocktails in a sense, because now it's just cocktails. It's
I mean, especially since, like, people have been making most of these drinks, or at least some incarnation of them, for a couple hundred years.
Yeah, totally.
So, for the most part, we're not really doing anything new.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, just like in music, you know, there's always new combinations of flavors and sounds. Mm-hmm. In any creative pursuit. You know,
I think that a lot.
It's kind of limitless. But
I think that a lot with music, because whenever somebody jumps on board saying, you stole this song from me or something, I think, okay, now if I can play that song right on top of another song, then sure, you stole it. But there are only so many combinations out there in the world.
Yeah.
So there are going to be plenty of times when you hit these kind of similarities and stuff. So, I mean, you might get a drink here that you're like, I came up with this combo, and then see something remarkably similar from some bar in Minnesota or something. And Yeah. I'm not going to jump to the conclusion that person stole it from me. They may also happen to like those ingredients, you know?
Especially when, you know, basically like all cocktails come from like one of three classic setups in terms of specs. I think that's kind of more understood in the bartending world.
Yeah.
And everyone's just a little more okay with that for whatever reason, you know?
They got to be kind of nice coming from this musical background where there is more of a proprietary sense to your songs.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, music just comes from such a deep emotional space.
Yeah.
That you're going to be more protective of that.
Agreed.
Than a drink.
and I think that maybe that's a nice aspect to it as well, is that I can make something that I really love and hopefully, you know, the person that I'm making it for loves it too. Mm-hmm. But if they don't, it's not like crafting a song, bearing your soul, and then showing it to someone or a crowd of strangers, and then, you know, having
no reaction.
Totally. So, with this, it's there's still, I think, you know, it's sustainable in terms of that you can actually make a living doing it.
Yeah,
but
and that.
It's also very,
you make a living doing
very creative.
It's easier to please probably your
customer. Yeah, I mean, it all kind of works together, and I think, I don't know, I guess I've always kind of gravitated towards bars like this one that kind of have a more, whether you want to call it dive bar or just like a rock and roll thing going on, but also with like a legitimate bar program where you can really have some creativity and
play around.
Yeah, access to ingredients and spirits.
It has a very casual feel, but I feel like, I mean, okay, Atomic has been here since what? Like
1952. Yeah, it's the
There's
oldest
even a
bar
time
in the
capsule
city.
On the floor.
Yeah.
It's the oldest bar in the city?
Oldest bar in the city.
Is it really?
Yeah.
I didn't know it was the oldest bar. I mean, I guess if you don't count bars that are in some of the really old casinos or something.
Yeah, the first six were in casinos.
Yeah.
This is the first tavern license.
Oh.
So the first freestanding bar.
Cool.
Yeah.
And part of the deal was, didn't people used to like come here after they watched the atomic testing or something?
I mean, the testing going on in the Mojave Desert was like a big thing that was happening at the time. And people, there were so many spots like this all over this part of the country where people would just gather to watch the
bombs.
I mean, really, you could see it from anywhere in the Vegas Valley, you know. But they just happened to name this place that. And it kind of became this thing of lore of people climbing up onto the roof and watching the bombs go off. I'm sure they did that.
Yeah.
There was never like an observation deck or something up there. I mean, I think it was just probably like a rickety ladder. And
I'm feeling like the first time I came here was probably in the 90s or something. And I used to DJ at punk rock dive bars, like in Northern California and in LA. So it always kind of appealed to me too to come in. And it's funny because I remember at some point there was a little cocktail menu, and I remember some of these drinks just being on the menu forever. But they were fun little drinks. And a few years ago, a friend of mine started working here, and he had come from the Edison in Los Angeles.
Andrew?
And he had been at Velveteen. And so I came out here to see him, and I was like, I really didn't know that this was a place where you could stretch those muscles, because I knew him as being such a fancy cocktail guy.
Yeah.
But then he seemed like such a natural in here as well. So it's nice that you can have those two things.
That's what
have the rock and roll and have, you know, rock and roll doesn't mean that you're totally gross and grungy.
Not at all.
It's a little nice drink.
I think it just kind of like, I'd like to think it helps shed some of the pretension that you run into the possibility of having in a fancy cocktail
it's
bar.
It's true. Absolutely.
I mean,
fancy
cocktail bars don't necessarily have to be pretentious.
Yeah.
But they sort of lend themselves to go that way.
Oh, they absolutely do. That's what I love about this. It's like a great beer selection. And the other night I was sitting here just looking at all the whiskeys here, and I'm like, oh, dude, they have this, and they have this, and they have this, and they have this. And these are some nice whiskeys here.
Yeah.
And you don't necessarily associate that with a dive bar.
Sure.
So it's like dive bar in disguise.
It really is, yeah. I mean, it's like a craft cocktail bar in disguise.
In disguise,
Or something like that.
Totally.
It makes it so much more approachable, too, to the average person.
Yeah.
And I think that you find this is a great place for people to really learn about
the
beer and the cocktail world, because the average Joe isn't going to feel intimidated coming in here, and maybe he's not going to start out drinking Boucherés, but he might be sitting next to somebody who is, and he might taste theirs, and all of a sudden it's not out of his realm anymore.
Yeah, I don't think people, like, especially a drink like that, you say, it's basically a cup full of booze.
Yeah.
That changes things a little bit. Like, sure. There's a couple extra ingredients in there. Well, let's talk about your rock and roll. So, did you start playing music when you got to San Diego, or was that, were you playing?
No, I'd been, so I was raised by a musician, and my mom's a songwriter and a singer.
So that was just going to happen.
And it just kind of, that was like what was expected of my brother and I. And I was raised on folk music and also on jazz. My first instrument was actually the alto sax.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which I still play. But as I kind of got more interested in rock and roll as I got into my teenage years, I kind of like let the jazz thing go by the wayside a little bit.
Yeah.
Started playing bass and guitar. Wanted to be able to sing while I was playing. Mm-hmm. And, wanted to play the kind of music that my friends and peers were interested in, because at the time they weren't too interested in Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
Really just kind of like learning to play various instruments, and actually most of my friends and even my little brother had all started doing bands kind of like around me, while I just hadn't really gotten to the point.
You mean they had already started and you hadn't done it yet?
Yeah, it was like I just, for whatever reason, I felt like I hadn't gotten to the point I wanted to be in order to present it to someone I didn't know. And it seemed like they were more comfortable with just like cutting their teeth in front of everyone, which is totally cool and respectable. I mean, in a way, I totally admire that. But it took me a little bit longer. But I guess when I was about, I was still living here, and I had graduated from high school. And I think I was like, I just graduated. So I was probably like 18 when I wrote my first like song or two that I actually felt like I wanted to play for anyone.
Yeah.
And I just started tracking demos in my parents' office and on like one of my mom's old 8-tracks.
Wow.
And I started a little band with my brother, and it was a little folk thing called The Vision of a Dying World.
Ooh, nice.
And, yeah.
That sounds very rebellious, actually.
Yeah, well, it was named after, it's the name of a hymn, but it was, I don't know. That project actually ended up going on for probably like most of a decade. And kind of that group kind of weaved its way in between all of my other musical projects throughout the course of my 20s. But by the time I moved to San Diego, we were kind of doing that in full force. And eventually, when that project started to peter out as like a group touring thing, me and one of the other guys from that band started a project called Cuckoo Chaos with some other friends of ours.
Okay.
And
now this was in San Diego.
And that was the first project that really kind of like took off for us in any kind of notable way.
Yeah.
I mean, we'd done all right like locally up to that point, and like certainly done our fair share of regional touring. But, you know, we were just like self-releasing music and, you know, how you do it when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And
what kind of music was it?
So
San Diego had a very specific sound for a long time.
It did. And we didn't really fit into that sound.
Uh-huh.
We definitely weren't a garage rock band.
Yeah.
Cuckoo was like kind of what it became was like an Afrobeat. Kind of like
that sounds awesome.
Progressive, like not. It wasn't prog. It wasn't really like Afro pop.
You should have been playing that in San Diego in the 90s. Because in the 90s, it was.
You think that would have worked?
Really eclectic there, because 90s was when it was ska and math rock.
Mm.
The prog thing was kind of.
That's true.
And the garage rock thing was always sort of there, but really, just after a while, it just became that thing.
Yeah.
But before, you could be weird.
Yeah,
it
I guess
was
you're
kind
right.
of expected. So like late 80s through like the mid 90s,
okay.
Could be kind of weird there.
Yeah,
so
that makes
by
sense
weird,
to
it's
me.
Just a little different, because what you're doing sounds amazing. Anything that even has like the inkling of Afro, like Afropunk, I'm totally into.
Yeah, I know those rhythms are just so like intrinsic.
Totally. They're very addicting to me. I really like them. So yeah. You guys were doing that.
Yeah, we were doing that. And it was like, I mean, it was, in a way, it was poppy and accessible because the songs were very melodic and we were doing like three-part harmonies and like interweaving guitar parts that people
could jam on. Was your brother still involved in this band?
He actually wasn't in that one. He'd kind of gotten more into electronic music at that point and was doing his own thing. Uh-huh. And we were just, you know, hanging on to the guitar.
So what were you playing at this point?
I was playing guitar and I was like singing lead on a couple songs, but more I was kind of like a second singer. And yeah, it was very much a group effort, mm-hmm. more so than any other project I've ever been in.
It's almost like kind of a yay-sayer kind of thing?
In a way, yeah.
Because that's when you say prog and kind of Afro whatever, I went to Vampire Weekend. I'm like, no, Prague, Yesayer. It's a little more this direction.
Both of those are dead on in a way. We often got compared to Vampire Weekend, I think just on a surface level, hearing those types of guitar tones and those kind of polyrhythms. They were so relevant and big at the time that it was like a natural place for people to go to.
Yeah.
But bands like Givers and like Yesayer, there was definitely... I mean, certainly, like, Talking Heads was kind of, like, a collective favorite within the project. So that kind of stuff, those world beat influences, stuff like Fela Kuti definitely, like, played a big role in how we were kind of shaping the music that we were making.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was cool. Really awesome. It was a ton of fun to play live.
I was going to say, actually, I could see you guys still playing out there because there's such a huge reggae community in San Diego, too, that's open to rhythms outside of that.
Totally. You know? Well, and, you know, the thing was that we honestly, and I think this is the case for a lot of bands, they find more success outside of their hometown than they ever do in it.
So where were you touring then?
So, I mean, we toured just, like, North America pretty heavy for, like, 3 or 4 years.
Wow.
But I would say that we got much more love in New York and L.A. than we ever did at home.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly had, like, a very devoted and faithful and encouraging small fan base in San Diego. But, you know, like... selling out a club of 150 or 200 people was about the max we could do at home, whereas we were playing much larger shows in other cities that we were going to, which is what it is.
It's what it is, yeah.
But, yeah, so we had a good run, and we put out a couple records and, you know, had a lot of opportunities, got to play with some really cool musicians, open up for some people, and just... yeah, it was great.
Really fun.
But
that wasn't your last band, though.
Actually, that was. Yeah. So when that broke up in probably like 2013, 2014, I had been doing music for so long and with so much of my heart and soul and just my time that I think I had kind of burned myself out a little bit.
Yeah.
And in a way, I kind of started to crush the thing that I loved the most.
It's really risky. Hanging on to it too tight
mm-hmm. and just, you know, wanting to do it in a certain way and really just like pushing for that. I mean, that's the kind of drive and ambition it takes, I think, to be a professional musician. I don't know, for me, I wasn't able to strike a balance between doing it as a labor of love and doing it to the point where we were like almost able to support ourselves doing it. It was like the closer we got to that, the less I liked it. So that was kind of when I naturally just sort of, well, I was like, okay, I'm gonna take a break from that. And then I was like, you know what? I've actually been bartending for a few years now, whatever, and I totally enjoy it. And it kind of very organically just became a thing that, because my creativity wasn't being put into music anymore, mm-hmm. more of that started to go into the drinks.
Yeah, and so how do you think, I mean, something else I've come across a lot is the bar family, or I should say, you know, behind the bar family versus, or... you know, along with the band.
Yeah.
Because I think they're both teams.
Definitely.
That you have to vibe with for things to be flowing properly. You know, you need a good team behind the bar, and you guys can help each other come up with new cocktails, new ideas, brainstorm off each other. And same thing with the band. If you've got a supportive group with you, the music is better.
Yes.
So has that experience proven true for you in this community as well?
Definitely. I mean, that was like the first thing... Once I got hired here, I mean, obviously, just from a patron's perspective, it's a cool place, and I could tell that like I wanted to work here. But the second that I got hired and was introduced to the first person that I met here, which may have been Carrie, I immediately felt at home. And I think that you're right. Like, there's a lot of commonality between your bandmates and your barmates.
Yeah.
And it's...
its own form of family, in a way.
Yeah,
bands
it's
are like
definitely,
marriages, practically.
They really,
you know,
are. Because, they're like group marriages.
Because you are pulling out your emotions and all this, and you're hitting yourself on that very personal level.
Yeah.
I don't think it's quite the same back here, but...
Yeah, there's differences that I think make it a little more bearable, yeah, in a way, just because you're not, like, trapped in a van or a tour bus with these
totally.
People for, like,
oh my God,
months
so
on
true.
End at a time. But also, there are things where, like, when Carrie and I are behind the bar together, it's almost like I know what she's going to do.
Yeah.
Like, I know the way in which she moves. I know where she's going to go next. And that's how we're able to work very quickly,
yeah,
without making a mess and bumping into
yeah.
each other back there. And
basic
very much
stuff,
in the
yeah.
same way, whereas if, you know, I'm the bass player of a band, it's like, I know what my drummer is going to do, just because that's what happens when you're interacting yeah. together on that kind of level for an yeah. extended amount of time.
So how is your music filtered into your cocktails? Mm. That has to have happened to you at this point.
I guess, like, a lot of my cocktail names I pull from
that's
rock
my
and
favorite.
Roll.
Yeah. I always ask people that question. It sounds like you've already done it.
In fact,
he's
I've
like,
wanted...
wait, let's look at the menu right
so,
now.
Yeah, so one of... One of mine that's on here is The Monkey Business,
uh-huh.
which I think is actually a more appropriate name, but I wanted to call it Monkey Gone to Heaven.
Oh, so it's a pixie string.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, well, it's got monkey shoulder in it, so
yes,
that's
and,
one.
Yeah.
Bananas, maple syrup, cream, egg whites, okay.
It's a holiday dessert cocktail for sure, but...
So do you, when that happens, do you have the song lyric in mind and then you build based on that, or do you... grab a couple of ingredients, you're like, oh, it's got this in it, or it just doesn't matter, depends.
I think it's totally random in some ways. Sometimes the names have more to do with the actual flavor or the profile of the cocktail. Sometimes it's just like, this song was stuck in my head while I was working on it.
And it became the
yeah.
name.
But I think that, you know, music and rock and roll provide this, like, constant soundtrack to my life,
yeah.
as it does for most people,
yeah.
especially of the last, like, few generations.
For sure.
And... I don't know, it's just always kind of there, so whether I'm actually, like, listening to it or not, it's kind of always going on in my head. And I think it kind of always informs what I'm doing, my perspective, my outlook.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what are some... one of the questions I always ask is, you know, granted, a lot of bartenders, I find, don't go home and mix themselves a cocktail anymore, you know?
This is true.
Maybe back in the day you did. Maybe just have a little bit of whiskey or have a beer or something like that. So if you were at home, what is your, like, if you're chilling out with a beer and some music, what's it going to be? Like, what's your come down stuff? Or maybe it's you're getting ready to go out for the night. Maybe
so,
you still do that.
At home, my fridge is always stocked with Miller Lite. It's pretty much like, I just want something watery
simple.
Yeah, totally crisp and refreshing when I'm drinking at home. Sometimes it's Modelo, I guess, one or the other. And then I'm usually just like sipping on something to accompany it. I do love agave.
I'm an agave person myself.
I do like whiskey as well, though, and I'm particularly partial to a lot of cordials, especially just
oh, really?
As sippers. Yeah, I like a lot of Amaros, and I mean, I always have a bottle of Fernet at home, mm-hmm. but I also
just
love
the basic
sip on...
Fernet, or do you, because there are many Vernets out there.
I like Fernet Branca, absolutely.
Yeah.
That, actually, of all of them
the
that I've tasted,
Brent.
That's still my favorite. but I do like a Verna as well, and I like Montenegro a lot, and
I
will
Montenegro.
Keep a bottle of those and just sip on them. Mm-hmm. I do like Chenard as well, mm-hmm. and I like pastises. I'll often
oh.
just drink some Pernod or some Ricard.
Oh, that's nice.
With a tasty Miller Lite to back it.
So. It sounds so sophisticated, and then you back it with
exactly.
Miller Lite.
Exactly. It balances. It's like this place.
That's
you
how
know?
It's rock and roll.
Yeah.
There you go.
Highbrow, lowbrow, all at the same time.
Well, what are you listening to while you're doing that?
So
if you get a moment, or is it just whatever your current obsession is?
Yeah, I mean, I go, you know, in and out of stuff just like everybody else. I think a common that kind of came back into my life at a certain point was jazz, mm-hmm. and that's kind of like been a constant for me throughout the years. Mm-hmm. Whenever I am at home, I try to listen to music on vinyl over going to digital, just because, whatever, I have it. I love buying records. I'm like, I may as well listen to them.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think there is a certain quality to vinyl that
Absolutely. It's very warm.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very warm.
Not that listening to it in a digital format, you're not going to get the fullest out of it, but whatever, it's there, so I'm trying to, you know.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of jazz records. Blue Note has reissued so much of their back catalog.
And
yeah, I just kind of compulsively buy them, and it's great music to have on in the background while you're doing something else that's still stimulating but doesn't necessarily draw your attention away to the point of distraction.
And jazz is what got you started playing music,
yes.
Right? I mean, who were some of those artists in the beginning? You were playing sax, so...
I was. Coltrane was definitely like one of the first that I remember getting
into.
How
old were you listening to Coltrane?
I was pretty young.
Wow, because I mean, most people don't start with Coltrane until they're like in college. You don't understand it, you know?
Yeah, I think I was kind of a weird kid.
Well, you had a very musical family.
I did.
So you had different kind of influences at home than most folks did.
And they raised me to be open, and I guess I just kind of naturally was inclined to be that way too.
Yeah.
So yeah, from maybe like, I don't know, 9 or 10, I remember having like a Coltrane CD that my dad got me. And I loved Sonny Rollins in terms of another sax player.
Yeah.
I don't know, Dizzy Gillespie and like everyone from Nat King Cole to Ella Fitzgerald.
You really didn't have anything to talk about with your classmates.
No, I did not. Yeah, and that dawned on me really quickly. As soon as somebody, you know, brought in like a Green Day CD, and I was like, yeah, that sounds cool. I was like, but are you into, you know, whoever? Yeah. And they were just like, what?
Rock and roll thing you remember really getting into?
So the first...
Your gateway drug, as it were.
Yeah. Well, I kind of remember like getting into like really saccharine pop music before actually getting into
Rock
and roll stuff. Yeah. Which I think that kind of lines me up more with like most kids out there.
Yeah.
I remember the first two tapes I ever bought, one of them was Ace of Base, The Sign.
Ooh, wow, okay.
Yeah, and then one of them was the single Michael Jackson. Right, no, it really doesn't. The single that Michael Jackson did for the Free Willy soundtrack.
What was the single for that?
With this 80s butt rock going on in the background, I can hardly think.
Right?
But,
we'll just look it up later.
Yeah, it'll come to me at some point here. But yeah, and then... After that, I think the first time I ever heard rock and roll that kind of profoundly hit me and resonated with me in a way where I immediately had to go buy that music was actually Weezer's Blue Album.
Oh, cool.
And I guess no one had ever, because of my background maybe, no one had ever played me any music that had the power and the essence of rock and roll, the brashness and the, I don't know, just that vibe.
Yeah.
But also had lyrics that definitely didn't take themselves seriously and were just kind of out there in a very tongue-in-cheek way.
Yeah, yeah.
And something about
just
that.
Fun.
Yeah.
Just like let loose and have fun kind of stuff, basically.
Yeah. So then, you know, from there, I realized that Weezer was just building on a whole world that had come before them, and I started finding out about bands like the Pixies and like Pavement and other bands that had influenced them very much.
Yeah.
And that was kind of where the rabbit hole started.
Yeah. But the band that your last band had this sort of kind of African aspect to it. How did you guys all find that you had a love of the world kind of sound?
So some of us had come more from a traditional place on that.
Uh-huh.
Particularly my lead guitar player and the lead singer. But they were also coming from, there was common ground between us because we were so into bands like the Talking Heads,
yeah,
that kind of like appropriated world rhythms into this like modern nerd rock music.
Yeah.
I was also a huge fan of Paul Simon, mm-hmm, and the work that he did in the 80s, yeah, on stuff like Graceland and Rhythm of the Saints was had a profound and deep effect on me. Mm-hmm. Actually, Graceland is one of the first records I can ever really recall hearing, like, in the context of this is an album and I'm listening to it.
Like, from start to finish, yeah, you were obsessed with the whole thing.
Yeah, as a child, I remember dancing around in my living room.
Yeah, oh, I remember listening. I mean, I was so in love with that record when it came out. There was, yeah, so much whimsy to it.
Yes.
But then it was also just beautiful and serious, too.
Yeah.
And you having that folky background, yep, as well lends to it. I've got an ethnic background. Uh-huh. So those kind of sounds were not unusual to me.
Yeah.
When I heard them, it was just a little different than what I was used to, the South American version of that.
Yeah.
And so it was really neat hearing that on the radio.
Yeah.
And everybody liking it.
Absolutely.
You know? It was kind of revelation.
Oh, it definitely was. Yeah.
And fun. And I also loved Talking Heads, too, and they definitely had stuff like that in there. So it was interesting how those puzzle pieces kind of came together in the 80s at that time.
Yeah.
That's amazing. What would the drink for your band have been? I'm wondering.
Oh,
like, what would that mix have been? Has that kind of world feel?
I mean, it would be like a daiquiri. It would be like a daiquiri made out of green chartreuse or something, you know?
That sounds like one of my favorite things ever.
There we go. It would be like something tasty and approachable, uh-huh, but then the second you start sipping on it, you realize that there's something slightly wrong with
it. It's a little weird. Yeah.
It wasn't exactly what you thought you were getting into.
But you're still liking it somehow.
Yeah, totally. You're going with it. You're not sure why, but you're there and it's too late now.
So do you think you'll head back into music at some point, or are you just enjoying yourself as a bartender right now?
Well, I've actually in the last couple years gotten kind of into photography as a creative pursuit.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And I've kind of jumped in headfirst with that one, uh-huh, and I'm just really loving it.
Awesome.
And, it's kind of this, it's like a second coming for me.
That's
In terms of, like, making art.
Yeah.
But it's also nice because not only do I not have all the, like, angst and kind of like the strife of being a teenager while you're trying to also like learn something and get, yeah, into something.
Yeah.
But I also am not looking at it, you know, with music it was so much like I always had this relationship with it where I was like, I think I could support myself doing this.
Yeah.
And then it was like the closer I got to that, obviously the more of a reality that seemed like it could be. Mm-hmm. And that just kind of made it like even more tense and tenuous in a way. And so with this, I'm kind of, it's been really nice because I've found like this thing that I do for money that I really enjoy,
yeah,
in this world here.
Yeah.
But then with the photography, it's this great, just creative place that I can go to, and it's a way to express myself and kind of share with others what I'm feeling through a visual medium,
yeah,
that I have absolutely no intention of pursuing in any way other than creatively. So like that pressure is just completely off of me. Now I know that like the entire time I was doing music, that was totally self-imposed pressure, but it was still there.
Yeah, totally. Well, I mean, the hope is that anybody who's in a band, well, not anybody, but the majority of people in bands hope to be somewhat successful with it.
Yeah.
Because the dream is to be able to just play music.
Yeah.
Keep playing music. And if you aren't someone where the dream is to play music, it's like, it'd be great to get to play music. That's the position you're in with your photography right now.
Right.
You know,
and
you don't have that pressure.
I'd like to, at some point, get back and reapproach music in the same way that I'm approaching photography.
Yeah.
Just with no expectations.
You just need more time.
I just need a little more time, you know. And then it'll just, you got to get to the point where you just have to have an instrument in your hand.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. And then it's like, then you really, it's time to do it.
Totally.
Yeah,
maybe
I can't
by then
force
you'll
it.
Have like a welcome captive audience that would just love to sit there and hang out with you and listen to you play guitar again.
We'll see.
You know?
We'll see.
Well, thank you so much for meeting with me today.
Thank
I
you
super
for chatting with
appreciate
me.
It.
I appreciate
it's
it.
It's wonderful. I love it. I think I do know your band. I have to go home and look through my stuff. I might even have a track or two from your band.
You might.
There's
an outside chance.
I'm going to check when I get home and I will report back to you.
Cool. Right.
But thank you so much.
Very welcome.
I have to give a big thank you to Jackson, who let me kind of commandeer him while he was working at Atomic Liquors. If you're ever in Vegas, you have to stop by the place. It is just classic. And as for Jackson, actually, everyone who works back there, stellar humans, a bunch of really great people, really creative people. It's a good group of humans over at Atomic Liquors. I've known some that have worked there in the past, and the crop that's currently there are pretty fantastic. So ask for Jackson, look him up, have him make you a wonderful cocktail, talk music with him, and I have an extra special surprise for you. Well, first off, let me remind you that we have a playlist on Spotify that Jackson put together. You can go to my Facebook page, Mo Herms, and find a link to that. And right now I'm going to play you something from his band. I actually did own a track from Cuckoo Chaos. This is a song called Jesus Flag American Fish.
Get up, 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 get up But I've been so lonely that I hadn't noticed you there. Susie, you are beautiful. But I've been so tired that I had been sleeping my life away. So I keep praying I'll get up, get up, get up.
Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com. And also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Thanks for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guests and our Spotify playlist, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. Please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.